Om Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Hare Krishna. we've asked Prabhu's permission. We're going to continue on with the seminar, Living Bhagavatam. We'll take up from where we left yesterday with Prabhupada's writing of the Bhagavatam. And then there'll be other features that come in. But yesterday we finished with the little comment about being careful about your sources when you're interviewing people and getting reminiscences about people's association with the pure devotee. You have to be a little careful who you talk to and verify their comments. So anyway, getting back to Prabhupada's activity of actually writing. Of course, from 1960 onwards, the Bhagavatam was occupying all of his time. As we saw, he stopped altogether working on the Back to Godhead, and he simply concentrated. He got three volumes of the Bhagavatam out within 3 years, practically. The first one, 62, next one, 63, next one, 64 at the end. 65, he was out. He was ready, and Krishna arranged for him to come to the West. Of course, his work was going on when Hayagriva first met him in 26 Second Avenue, and he offered to do some typing. Then Prabhupada, you know, he asked him, do you have any more typing to do? And he said, oh, yes. He opened his drawer up, and there's a stack of about 2,000 pages or something that needed to be retyped. So Prabhupada was very, very busy. And writing, of course, was his main occupation. So on the 22nd of April, 1976, Prabhupada was in Melbourne. And he was waiting for some guests to come. So whilst we were waiting, myself and Pushyakrishna Swami, who was the secretary at that time, we were just sitting in the room with Prabhupada, just chatting about various things. And Pushyakrishna Maharaj asked Srila Prabhupada if many people had been coming to hear from him before he came to the West. Prabhupada said that people were coming, but that he had no time to visit many places or people because he was busy with his writing. To me, it seemed very significant that Prabhupada had reversed the usual trend. Generally, somebody retires and then dedicates their remaining days to writing. But Prabhupada wrote, and then he came out to teach his teachings by practical example. Pushyakrishna Swami added that he didn't think that Krishna consciousness would have had much effect upon people without Prabhupada's personal example. And Prabhupada modestly agreed. He said that was the example of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, to teach by personal example. So later on, a couple of months later, we were in New York, and Prabhupada received a letter from Yasamadi Nandana Prabhu from Gujarat. We had been there at the end of 1975 for a week. Yaso had gone there with his wife and a couple of other devotees. Hi-Hiya was there at one point. And they were trying to set up a yatra there, ISKCON Center, in Ahmedabad. So on July the 11th then, Yaso sent a report on their activities in Ahmedabad, and he described a highly successful Rath Yatra festival. It was organized by all the local Hindu temples, and the Mahant of the local Jagannath temple had presided over it. The devotees had had kirtan on the back of a truck during the parade, which the whole city populace had witnessed. By simply leaning over the side of the truck, They had sold 1,500 of the newly printed Gujarati magazine, Bhagavat Darshan, without even getting off the truck. Yasmadi Nandan said that he felt that this was a new record for Indian book distribution. However, he said that because they had aimed at making sure that everybody could get one, they had charged only 1 rupee each. So thus they only made 20 paisa profit on each magazine. Yasmadi Nandan's description of how they got to participate in the parade was very interesting. He said, "It was by your direct mercy that we got a place on the truck, because when we went to meet the Mahant of the Jagannath Temple, he refused to see us because he thought that we were hippies." Then there was another sadhu who was standing just nearby, and he knew your divine grace very well. So he said, "Oh, you were disciples of Bhaktivedanta Swami?" We said, "Yes." So then he went to the Mahant and introduced us. Then the Mahant said, "Okay, so then they can come on Tuesday and join in the temple truck with a few sadhus of their own." So that's how we got in. This sadhu's name was Narayan Das, and he is the Mahant of the Nilkant Mahadev Ranji Mandir in Vadigam. He said that your divine grace had stayed with him for almost 6 months in his ashram 15 or 20 years ago. This is 76, so that puts it back. 15, 20, that means, in the early 60s. He was nice, and he said, "Swamiji was a great scholar and was giving lectures in the ashram every day. All day he was writing on the Bhagavatam. He was eating only once, and in the evening, just taking milk." So that was, that was a feature that Prabhupada maintained. Every evening, he would have that glass of milk, the last thing, before he went to sleep, or, to take a little rest. But that was a confirmation of what Prabhupada had told us. He was very busy with his writing, and therefore he wasn't going out much or, talking to too many people. He was doing some preaching, but his main thing was to write. So, of course, when I joined the party in late 75, Prabhupada had a pretty well-established routine. And we all knew that he was writing during the middle of the night. He would get up, or he would take rest maybe around about 10 o'clock. He would usually get up when I was with him around about 11 or 11:30, 12 o'clock at the latest. And then he would spend the rest of the night translating through till at least 4 o'clock or Mangalarti time. I never really asked him, and Shridakirti is here, maybe you could add something to this, as to when he actually established that routine. Did you ever ask him about that? we just kind of slotted in with that. But as far as I can tell, I think that the demands of management in ISKCON forced him to start trying, doing all of his writing work at night time. And from what I could understand, in the pre-ISKCON days, he was working in the daytime mainly. It may be also that he was working at night time. I'm sure. Typing. So I'm sure that Prabhupada, he was working, at all hours. But there was a letter that I did find just recently, and I've added it into this this seminar. This was a letter that Prabhupada wrote to Jadarani on the 16th of December in 1967. So this is when he just returned from India after, he had his heart attack. He was very seriously ill for quite a long time. He was suffering the after effects of what appears to have been a stroke, because initially when he got that heart attack, he was actually paralyzed down the left-hand side. And it was only because he had constant massage for quite a long time that he actually regained the use of his left arm and leg. And then he appeared to be normal again. But he said for many months afterwards he would have this noise in his head. Gong, 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 like this. He said it was constant. He said I was half crazy. It was just you know, for months it was going on like that. So anyway, this is at the end of 1967 when he appeared to have recovered sufficiently and he was starting to travel around a little bit again. So he wrote to Jadarani, "Please convey my blessings to Satsvarup and Pradyumna. Inform Satsvarup that very soon I am going to overload him with tapes for typing. My dictaphone is a little out of order. Gagamuni has taken charge of repairing it. And as soon as I get back my work on Srimad Bhagavatam, that will begin. At the present moment, I have got some difficulty in sleeping. I cannot sleep more than 3 hours at night and 1 hour in the day. So if that continues like that, and if I keep fit, I think that I shall have ample time to work on writing my books." So Prabhupada was able to dovetail, you know, what would have been a difficulty for anybody else. But he saw this is a good opportunity. I can't sleep anymore, so this gives me more time, you know, to do my writing. So it seems at least from 67 or, you know, 68 onwards, that was, you know, that was his schedule. Although he may have been writing throughout the night previous to that, but it became kind of formalized there. And, you know, with the expansion of ISKCON, round about 67, end of 67, there were 5 temples in America. There was about 50 or 60 devotees. From 68 up until the end of 71, that expanded 10 times. There was, at the end of 71, there were about 50 temples, or 60 temples, and there was over 600 devotees. So Prabhupada told me one time that ISKCON really actually took off from 68 onwards. So there was this huge expansion that went on. And then from 72 to 77, the number of disciples went from 600 to 5,000, and the number of temples went from 60 up to 108. So how Prabhupada was able to cope with that expansion and still do his main work is, I mean, it's amazing. You know, so much management was coming down on him. He had all these raw hippies that he had to train up to be Vaishnavs and take charge of, you know, huge responsibilities. And at the same time, he had his own responsibilities for doing his Bhagavatam work. So anyway, that routine then, when I joined the party, as I say, end of November, this was on December the 5th, the evening massage took more than half an hour. Lately, the weather has been cold throughout the night until sunrise. Actually, when we went to Vrindavan in early December, that was the first time that I saw Prabhupada get really angry. He called in Gopal Krishna and Akoyananda. They were the managers there at Krishna Balaram Mandir. And there was no hot water. And Vrindavan in December is really cold and the water is really icy. And he couldn't brush his teeth because it was so cold. So he called them in and he demanded to know where Saurabh was. He said, "We've spent, you know, 30 lakhs building this building." And I said, "Yeah, I can't even get hot water." I was a little afraid, actually. I'd never seen Prabhupada get angry like that before. But then, you know, because later on I got a little bit used to it. But anyway, it was cold. And does Prabhupada's circulation and joints need more attention? So that evening massage was extending a little bit. And I took rest about 11 o'clock. So as we disciples slept, Prabhupada rose at 11:30 or midnight to begin his most important work of the day, the translation of the Srimad Bhagavatam and the writing of his transcendental purports. Harikesh is a light sleeper, and he often awakens as Prabhupada goes through the servants' room on his way to the darshan room. So he would take that route from his back bedroom into the front one. Rolling over in his sleeping bag, he offers his obeisances as Srila Prabhupada passes by. So sometimes we would do that. When we came here to New Dwarka, up in Prabhupada's quarters there, they'd converted the servants' room into a kitchen. So I couldn't keep my... I was keeping my stuff in the broom closet. And in the night time, I was sleeping on that little walkway up to, you know, between Prabhupada's bathroom and his sitting room. So several times Prabhupada came through to use the bathroom, and I heard him, so I rolled over and, you know, same thing. You're in your sleeping bag, you roll over and off your obeisances. Prabhupada said, no, no, it's all right. You sleep. So sitting at his desk, Prabhupada chanted japa for an hour or so in complete concentration on the holy names. He prayed to Krishna for the ability to serve him nicely and to present the eternal words of the Srimad Bhagavatam in a manner just suitable for the understanding of the entire world, conscious that his work will form the basis for law and order in the next 10,000 years. That was my own comment, but we understood that was, you know, that was what was going on. Putting aside his japa mala, he donned his spectacles and clicked on the desk light. He opened the Bhagavatams at the bookmarks, the green Varanasi edition with the Sanskrit commentaries of previous acharyas, and the red Bengali edition with the commentaries by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. He leaned forward and studied them intently. The microphone close to his mouth, he flicked on the tape and began his dictation. Srimad Bhagavatam, 7th canto, 7th chapter, verse 25, purport continued. That night was actually that verse. I kind of researched it and I found out what verses he was working on the individual notes. So it was actually, that was the section that he was on at that time. So that was Prabhupada's routine every night. And, you know, he would have to be really seriously ill to not do that. So later on, we were here in America. We went up to Toronto in mid-June. And on the 18th, Prabhupada met with some professors from the local university. Joseph O'Connell was one of the main ones. He had met, I think, Prabhupada one time in London previously. He was a fairly young guy at that time. I think he was about 35 or so. Nice guy, very friendly. A little bit proud of his scholarship. I went to see him about 10 years after this, or actually in the early 90s, even later than that, just to kind of interview him when I was working on this section of my diary. And the first thing that he said, he was friendly, but he said, of course, Prabhupada wasn't a scholar. You know, that's their academic, you know, attitude. Prabhupada wasn't a scholar. But apart from that, he was, you know, kind of friendly. Anyway, so they were there. They were talking with Srila Prabhupada. O'Connell had suggested to Srila Prabhupada that he send his disciples to the university to take their degrees in philosophy. Later on, Prabhupada said that means that they're losing their jobs. Nobody's interested in philosophy anymore. They're all interested in technology. So he's coming and canvassing, right? So he can keep his job. So anyway, Prabhupada was very sharp because he asked Prabhupada, why don't you send your disciples, you know, to come and study? Then Prabhupada immediately took advantage of that, and always conscious of his mission and aware of the slightest opportunity for preaching, he suggested that they should consider using his books for their texts in their classrooms. And he cited the recent orders that he had received from East Germany. So at that time, Ganesheim, Bhaktitirtha Maharaj, was in East Germany and sending reports how he was selling his books there. So one of the professors asked Srila Prabhupada how long it had taken him to complete the Chaitanya Charitamrita, especially wondering when he found the time to write. Prabhupada told him that it took him a year and a half to complete the 17 volumes. It's unbelievable when you think about that. It's a year and a half. And he was doing the Bhagavatam at the same time and traveling and preaching. 17 volumes in 18 months. That's one volume a month. So he said, I write in the night. I go to bed at 10:30. I get up at 12:30. Then I finish my chanting if there is any balance. And then I begin my dictating. And the morning, they take it and type it. So this dictaphone is always with me wherever I go so that my writing book is not stopped. Maybe a few pages, but something is there daily. Little drops of water wear away the stone. So in that way, we have translated so many books. About 54 books are already published, besides the small booklets. 60 volumes. And we have published the Bhagavatam 22. So I'm expecting 60 volumes. 60 volumes of 400 pages. The biggest canto is the 10th canto. So I've already published the 10th canto, summarized, Krishna. But in detail, it will take at least 20 volumes. One of his guests observed, well, then the 10th is almost as big as the rest of the book. Yes, Prabhupada said, there are 90 chapters. All the other cantos, at most, 30 chapters. But the 10th canto, 90 chapters. That is Krishna's face, Krishna's beautiful face. Everybody is attracted by the smiling face of Krishna. So that was nice. And, because that was Prabhupada's ambition, 60 volumes of the Srimad Bhagavatam. And if you see that original flyer that he had printed up when he left India, he had a little one-sheet advertisement. He advertises there that, 60 volumes, Srimad Bhagavatam, elaborate English translation by Tridandi Swami Bhaktivedanta, like this. And at that time, of course, he only had 3 volumes, but he was already advertising 60 volumes. So Prabhupada was very ambitious, and he had the determination, to do it also. It wasn't just talk. he was actually doing it. So a couple of months later, we were at Bhaktivedanta Manor. This was on July 26, and George Harrison came. Prabhupada had his secretary write to him and invite him to come when we arrived at the manor. So George came. I think it was the last meeting that they had, actually. And Prabhupada was quite sick at that time. When we left New York, he had a heavy, almost like a flu. And then flying over in the nighttime on the aeroplane, by the time we got to the other end, he was really, really sick. And in fact, he asked us to get him a wheelchair to get him off the plane. I mean, Prabhupada was a very self-sufficient person. He was, if he could do something himself, then he preferred to do it that way. He liked to, So for him to ask for a wheelchair, it was really serious. So Gurudas had gone off to try to find out, where to get a wheelchair from. In the meantime, Prabhupada decided he didn't want to sit on the aeroplane and wait for it. So he got up and he got off. And he was walking down the corridor, and he was swaying from side to side. He was so, because if you have a cold and you fly on the aeroplanes, they tell you not to fly, because all your mucus and life airs and everything get disturbed, and you get really, really dizzy, and usually you throw up. And so Prabhupada was, I presume he was so dizzy from the flight, and, so blocked up. He was actually swaying from side to side as he was walking down the corridor. And I had to walk behind him with my hands just kind of nearly under his armpits, just in case he fell over. Then after we'd gone some distance down the corridor, and Heathrow Airport, long, long corridors. Yeah, it's like you walk about half a mile or something just to get to the immigration. So Gurudas came running up behind. I've got the wheelchair. Okay, bring it. Well, the airlines refused to send it down. You have to walk back to the aeroplane to get on the wheelchair. So they wouldn't bring it down the corridor. So Prabhupada refused to turn around and walk back. So he just kept on going. Anyway, on the way to the manor, we had to stop the car twice. He threw up. He was really sick. So the first 3 days he spent practically at the manor, he was in bed. And not doing any programs. Then he recovered a little bit. When George came, Prabhupada was sleeping, and he had given me an instruction that if George comes whilst I'm sleeping, then wake me up. So, Shridhakirti, that if Prabhupada was sleeping, that there was a kind of a standing rule. You don't wake Prabhupada up for anybody. Doesn't matter, if it's the Prime Minister of India or the Queen of England, or they have to wait. But Prabhupada said, if George comes, wake me up. So I woke him up. And I thought Prabhupada would get up and go into the sitting room and receive him there, but he didn't. He sat up in bed. He said, bring him in. So we brought George in. Gurudas was there. Mukunda was there. Jaitirtha, Dhananjaya, Balagopal, you know, there was like a little group of seniors there. And Prabhupada said, all right, sit down and eat. So they'd cooked a feast for him, and Prabhupada had all the pots brought into the bedroom, and he had George sit down, and then he fed him. He had us feed him, and then they were chatting as he was eating. So we just got the seventh canto. I think the third part had just been given to Prabhupada just as we were leaving New York. So Prabhupada immediately presented one of his personal copies to George. So Prabhupada asked George if he was reading his books at all. George said that he was, mainly the Krishna book. Mukunda gave me the new books, he said, but there's just so much. There's just so much to read. I don't know how anybody could have written it. It's difficult enough to read all of that amount. A Prabhupada acknowledged his appreciation. Sometimes they are surprised how one man can write so many books. But it is by Krishna's grace, he said humbly. Otherwise, not possible. For a human being, it is not possible. Ranshaw looked up a verse. So we got talking. There was a particular verse that Prabhupada quoted. And Ranshaw looked it up. While George expressed his respect for Srila Prabhupada's hard labor, he said, these books are such a lot of work. I don't know how he did it all. Gurudas Maharaj explained that Prabhupada translated at the night. And Prabhupada added, at night I don't sleep. Not because that nowadays I am sick, but generally I don't sleep. At most 2 hours. So I take a little rest during the daytime. So on the whole, 3 to 4 hours. But actually I don't like to sleep. George empathized. No, it's a waste of time. Prabhupada said, I think it is. When I go to sleep, I think, now I'm going to waste my time. I actually think like that. What is the word for it? George said. They call it the little death. Sleep is the little death. The Prabhupada quoted Prahlad's instructions in the seventh canto, part 2. He is estimating you've got 100 years at most. So out of that, 50 years are lost, sleeping. And then 20 years playing as a child, as a boy. So then he had me read out the verses that describe how a materially attached person wastes an entire lifetime of 100 years. George showed some interest in those verses, and so Prabhupada gave him that volume of the Bhagavatam too. So it was nice. George was appreciating how Prabhupada was working so hard. And, I was continually amazed at the effort that Prabhupada put into writing his books and the concentration that went into it as well. So when we had gone to Hawaii, that was in May, we spent the whole month of May. Rameshwar had come in April to Vrindavan, and he had informed Prabhupada that now the BBT has practically caught up with him. Because the previous year in 75, that was the famous marathon when Prabhupada ordered all the backlog of books here in LA. They had to produce them all. 17 volumes in 2 months, he said. I want them all printed. So they'd done that. And then Rameshwara, then he had come. Because Prabhupada said, I'm getting discouraged. I'm doing the translations, but you're not keeping up with me. And so I'm not feeling like I should, I'm not feeling encouraged to do any more work if you're not going to publish them. So Rameshwar had come and he had told Prabhupada, now we're only one volume behind you. And he said, as you translate, he said, we can publish another volume within 1 month of you giving us the material. So Prabhupada became very encouraged. And then Rameshwar said, we'd like you to stay 1 month in Hawaii and then you'll be undisturbed. There'll be no visitors. And then you can increase your writing. So Prabhupada said, yes, very good. So he did just that. When we got to Hawaii, immediately he got into this incredible schedule. He was writing in the daytime. He was writing all night. Some nights he didn't sleep. He just worked all the way through. It was amazing. So on May the 10th, then, 1976, this was a codicil. So before going out for his morning walk, Prabhupada summoned me with his buzzer. Going into his room, I offered my obeisances and knelt before him, eager to execute his bidding. He asked if we had the Sanskrit edition of the Srimad Bhagavatam 8th canto with us. He said that he would finish the 7th canto by the evening. This was very heartening to hear. Last month in Vrindavan, we discussed the travel itinerary with Rameshwara Swami. As I've said, we made this arrangement for him to spend. So now it looks like he's making good progress, and he is at one. And it was at once fulfilling and inspiring. I was excited, and I expressed my pleasure at this welcome news. Prabhupada remained modest and sober. With a slight smile and an unassuming tip of his head, he told me, "Oh, I can finish it very quickly, but I have to present it for your understanding. It requires deep thought, very carefully, for the common man." So then in the evening at 9:15 p.m., Prabhupada again called for me. I was expecting him to be getting ready to take rest and have his massage, but I was surprised to find him that he was sitting at his desk with his spectacles on, his Bhagavatam open, and his dictaphone in his hand. He told me that he would not take his massage. Rather, he said that he would finish translating the 7th canto. I was surprised but elated. This is the first time that I've been with him, over 5 months, that he has completely missed his evening rest. He worked all night, all through the night, and then after going for his early morning ablutions, I checked his dictaphone, and I saw that he had notched up 320 digits on the counter. This is on the dictaphone. Normally, he does 50 or less, so he'd done about 7 times the amount that he was normally doing. He was able to get into 25 verses of the 8th canto during the night. He's mercifully fulfilling our hope that by spending extra time here in Hawaii, away from management problems and constant streams of visitors, that he would be able to concentrate on the essence of his preaching work. Everyone is growing very heartened to see how much extra writing he is doing since his arrival in Honolulu. So that particular night then, Prabhupada finished the 7th canto, and if you read the 7th canto, you'll see this footnote that he puts at the end. He says, "Thus ends the Bhaktivedanta purports to the 7th canto, 15th chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled Instructions for Civilized Human Beings, completed on the night of Vaishakhi Shukla Ekadasi, the 10th of May, 1976, in the temple of Panchatattva, New Nabadweep, Honolulu, by the mercy of Sri Krishna Chaitanya, Prabhu Nityananda, Sri Advaita Gadadhar, Sri Vasadi Gaura Bhaktivrinda. Thus we may happily chant, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare." That was nice. So a couple of days later, May the 15th, Hayagriva had just arrived. So he was making a little bit of a comeback. He'd been out for a few years, and then he'd come back. And then the BBT had discussed with him that Prabhupada had this philosophy book, what we used to call the philosophy book. And somehow or another, it had been going on and going on, and Prabhupada kept asking about when this book is going to be done, and they weren't doing it. So they engaged Hayagriva to finish the philosophy book. So he wanted to come and sit with Prabhupada and interview him, go over some of the old discussions that he'd had about with various philosophers, and clean up a few of those interviews, and then do some new philosophers. So he came in to Hawaii, and that's every day. He was meeting with Srila Prabhupada 2 or 3 hours and discussing all this heavy, heavy philosophy, all different, you know, personalities. So despite the disruptions of the day, Prabhupada and Hayagriva discussed the philosophies of Socrates and Plato for 2.5 hours this evening. Then afterwards, Prabhupada went straight into his translation work. So again, he didn't sleep. He just had a 2.5 hour session with Hayagriva. And he dictated throughout the night and notched up another 315 digits on his dictaphone. So he was doing an amazing amount of work. And one nice example of how much concentration Prabhupada was applying. As he said, I have to do it very carefully. It requires deep thought. Otherwise, you know, just translating is easy. But thinking about every word that goes into the purport, how to present it, that's where the real essence of it was. So later in the year, Prabhupada was in Vrindavan. We'd been there a couple of months. This was on November the 8th. So just after taking rest at 11 p.m., I heard the buzzer ring. Rolling out of my sleeping bag, I went into Prabhupada's darshan room, where he was already sitting at his desk, microphone in hand, peering over the pages of the Bhagavatam. So I think he probably rested about half an hour, you know, just giving him the massage. As soon as I took rest, he got up and he went straight in. So after offering my obeisances, I sat before him, eager to know the purpose of his call. Prabhupada looked at me over his glasses, and indicating something in midair, he said, "There's some noise disturbing. Just stop it." I listened, but there was only silence to my ear. Seeing my puzzled expression, Prabhupada's eyebrows raised and his finger pointed upwards. "No, just listen." He was watching me, too. I was kind of trying to figure out what's going on here. So again, I listened hard, trying to open up my ears and perceive whatever it was that was disturbing his divine grace. After a few seconds, I started to pick up on what seemed to be a very faint, distant hum. Prabhupada was observing me very closely, and when he saw the dawn of recognition on my face, he confirmed my perception. "Ha! Now, go and find it and stop it." Now tuned in, I walked off through the entrance door, following the sound which seemed to be coming from a source high up and distant. Going outside, I moved towards the temple and the sound receded. Going the other way, towards the guest house, the faint vibration began to increase. I entered the building and I started up the staircase, and the humming began to increase in volume the higher that I climbed. Finally, I arrived at the top floor of the four-story building, sure by this time that I had identified the cause. Going down the corridor, I banged on the door of one of the single rooms. After a minute, the door opened to reveal a sleepy, agitated Vishal Das, who was quite grumpy about being awakened at such a late hour. "Vishal Prabhu," I said humbly, "you've got your fan on, and it's disturbing Prabhupada in his translation work." The fan was hanging from the ceiling, and it was whirring around at full tilt, and I couldn't think why he would have had it on in the cold of a winter's night. But there was no discussion. Vishal was immediately profusely apologetic at the thought that he might be causing an inconvenience to Srila Prabhupada, and he quickly shut it off. After thanking him, I went back down to Prabhupada's quarters, and when I entered, he was already deeply absorbed, sitting by the light of his desk lamp, studying the text, and flicking on and off the switch of his dictaphone microphone as he constructed his purports. He gave me but a brief glance of acknowledgement, and I took rest, impressed by the intense concentration that Prabhupada applies to his work, and grateful for the opportunity to assist him in it. So it was just a fan, four stories high, but Prabhupada was concentrating so much, you know, it was just... So, sometimes if the noise was too much, I saw when we arrived in Fiji, this was at the end of April, I thought, you know, we're going to Fiji, it's very quiet, there'll be no visitors, there was just a few devotees there. And in those days, Fiji didn't even have a TV station. Yeah, there was no satellite transmissions, and they had no local TV, so it was like a paradise. You know, had no advertising hoardings or anything. It was just like a very simple, pristine kind of place. So I thought Prabhupada's going to do a lot of work here. So after the first day, I went into his room, and Prabhupada was sitting there chanting. He said, "I couldn't work." And I asked him why. So he said the dogs, he said they're howling all night long. So, you know, every night it was like, it was similar to being in Vrindavan, but different. If you've ever stayed in Vrindavan, at night time sometimes, the peacocks, they all gather up in the trees. And then sometimes they start, meow, 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 like this. And they start in one place, and then it goes all around Vrindavan. Yeah? There are, you know, there's different groups of them. They, one starts, and then the others start, and then the others, and it goes all around like this. It's very nice. But in Fiji, it was the dogs. So, you know, the dogs were in one area, they started barking, and then the dogs in the next area, they picked up on it. So it was going on all night long, just barking. And Prabhupada said I couldn't work. There was too much noise. So he hardly got any work done because he just couldn't concentrate because of the dogs. Anyway, so writing them, Prabhupada put a lot of effort into, you know, his Bhagavatam work. On July 16th, 1976, he was in New York, and he had a visit from George Orwell. Not the George Orwell. This was George Orwell of the Associated Press. So, also a writer, but he was the religions editor for Associated Press. So, George had actually tried to meet with Prabhupada once before, a couple of years before, when he was still in Brooklyn. Somehow or another, he didn't get his interview. Now he came to West 55th Street, and he had a fantastic interview. It was really, really good. Very intense. Prabhupada gave some wonderful analogies for him to try to understand, you know, the difference between spirit and matter. And eventually they got to a point. George asked Srila Prabhupada what he thought about Judaism and Christianity. Prabhupada said he didn't know because he hadn't studied them. But if any religion, he said, any religion, if it frees its adherents from the bodily conception of life, it was first class. Mr. Orwell said that he didn't think that they did that. He thought that they considered the body to be important and they cherished the world. Prabhupada responded that such a conception was ignorance. He explained that he was attracting people from every religion and community because real knowledge is for everyone. Just as 2 plus 2 equals 4 is the same for everyone, and gold is gold, same for everyone. Mr. Orwell asked, who has the gold? Just the Krishna consciousness movement, or are there other paths to spiritual enlightenment? Prabhupada replied that there are other paths, but they're not very elaborate. This prompted Mr. Orwell to ask if Krishna consciousness was elaborate. Prabhupada indicated his bookshelf. We're explaining this science in so many books. It is open to everyone. A writer himself, Mr. Orwell was very impressed with Prabhupada's output, especially when we told him that another 40 volumes were yet to come. Are all of these translations that you've made, Your Grace? I don't blame you for sleeping only 4 hours a night. I tell you, just to produce a half a dozen books in a lifetime is quite a job, you know. Prabhupada admitted, it is very difficult. But I've already produced 80 books, and all world scholars, professors, universities, they are receiving so nicely. So he was a writer. This man's, you know, a journalist. That's what he does every day. But he was amazed by how much Prabhupada had done. So previous to that, we've been in Los Angeles. This was on June the 9th. And, of course, there was a lot of talk between Rameshwara Swami and Srila Prabhupada, a lot of BBT work that was going on there. And, of course, wherever there's Prabhupada and Rameshwara Swami, there must be some talk about books. Rameshwara praised Srila Prabhupada for his prolific literary output. People are surprised that you have written so many books, he said. They cannot understand how you can write so much. They wonder whether you were a great Sanskrit scholar for many years, or they try to guess. They just can't imagine anybody writing so much. Prabhupada modestly acknowledged the compliment. We are exceeding all material authors, except Vyasadeva. One book, 17 volumes, Chaitanya Charitamrita. So many of our God brothers, they attempted. So I asked, have any of your God brothers translated anything? Prabhupada shook his head. They died halfway finished. He said somewhat wryly. So Rameshwara said, they wonder where you have made the time to study so much about ancient Indian culture that you could write so much. They can't understand it. There's a biography of your divine grace in the Bhagavatam that mentions different things, and they just can't understand how you could know so much. It's beyond material comprehension. Prabhupada smilingly narrated an incident that he is fond of recalling. Yes, one young man in Tokyo or some airport, very nice young man, he came. So I was sitting. Swamiji, can I talk with you? Yes. So I have seen your photograph. Where have you got so much vast knowledge? And I said, it is not my knowledge. It is Vyasadeva's knowledge. But this was his first question. An intelligent boy. Prabhupada liked that. He often used to cite that. Where have you got such vast knowledge? He said, it's all from Vyasadeva. And actually, there was a review that Prabhupada got from somebody in India later on in 1976. And this professor, he compared Prabhupada's writings. He said, his writings are so, you know, voluminous and deep. He said, one wonders whether he's the same Vyasadeva reborn to represent his own works. And when Prabhupada heard that, he was smiling like anything. He really, really liked it. He said, oh, he is appreciated very nicely. So, of course, another writer in our line, setting the example, was Bhaktivinoda Thakur. And on August 11th, Prabhupada was in Tehran. And, of course, there the yatra was all householders mainly. Navayovana was there with his wife. Atreya Rishi, of course, was in charge. He was there with his wife. Gyanagami Prabhu, he was there. I think he was still a brahmachari at that time. Paribraja Kacharya Swami, he was there doing some preaching in the royal palace there, teaching the Shari of Iran's niece how to do Hatha Yoga. It was an interesting yatra. And Dayananda and Nandarani were there. So all the householders, they were working during the daytime. Dayananda was working for IBM. Treya had he was working for Arthur Young. He had opened up a branch of their accountancy firm there in Tehran. So like that. So Prabhupada was only giving class for 10 or 15 minutes at the most in the mornings. And then they would go off to work. So Prabhupada knew about that. So in his class he was telling us that although in the spiritual world we do not have to work to maintain our existence, here in the material world we do. Yet we still have to become Krishna conscious. His words were pertinent because as soon as he finished his lecture, Atreya Rishi, Dayananda and the others would be going out to engage in seemingly mundane jobs. So Prabhupada cited another example to encourage them that what they are doing is actually spiritual. Because a devotee, he said, has nothing to do with material things. Even if he works for the maintenance of his body, that is not material. Just like Bhaktivinoda Thakur, who was a magistrate. So it is not for a magistrate to write so many books, Siddhanta Purnam. So he was on a different, transcendental platform. So that is possible. The mind may be absorbed in Krishna's thought, Satatam Kirtayantomam, Tushyanti Cha, Ramanti Cha. So that is possible by practice. So it's a nice example that, you know, he was working, but he was writing so many books, and that was all happening on the transcendental platform. So similarly with Srila Prabhupada, you know, it's all purely transcendental activity. So another interview that Prabhupada had done was this one that he did with Newsweek magazine. Again, that was in New York in July of 76. And this man, I think it was Kevin Lehart, he was there. No, sorry, Newsweek. This was a young reporter that had come, and it was quite funny, actually, because we thought Newsweek, you know, one of the big two magazines. Prabhupada had never really had an interview either with Time magazine or Newsweek. And for that last tour, Rameshwar had hired a publicist. He was paying her $2,000 a month to line up interviews with all the big newspapers and whoever else they could get. So she got this interview lined up with Newsweek. when the reporter came, it turned out she was just a junior reporter. So as they were coming up the elevator in West 55th, Prabhupada's quarters were on the 11th floor there. It was, you know, reported to Prabhupada, oh, they've just sent this woman reporter. She's a young woman. And Prabhupada said, all right, I don't want to see her. You talk to her. And they said, but Prabhupada, she's already up. She's just about to come in. And he said, she'll just come in. She'll ask, how much money have you got? How many temples have you got? Like this. So he said, you talk to her. So anyway, she came in. She sat down. She starts talking to him. And then, you know, immediately she, how much money have you got? How many times? So Prabhupada just refused to be interviewed. Right? This is just from Newsweek. And he just wouldn't cooperate. So the whole thing within a few minutes just kind of started to break down. And Prabhupada, she asked Prabhupada this question. And Prabhupada said, why should I tell you? So Rameshwara is sitting there in complete anxiety, right? Because he spent some money. The publicist is there and she's just kind of holding her head, you know, what's going on here? And so to try to get things back on track, Rameshwara then immediately said, well, you know, Prabhupada's written so many books. This is his main work. So he was trying to direct it that way. And then as soon as he said that, Prabhupada immediately just changed completely around and started opening up and talking again. So the mention of his books gave Srila Prabhupada the opportunity to guide the interview in the direction that he wanted. So he began to open up a little. He told Wanda that if she really wanted to understand something about him, she should read his books, because a man is known by what he speaks. Tavat chashobate mukayo yavat kinchin napasasa abhashate. A fool is so long beautiful as long as he does not speak. So as long as you can keep up an appearance, you're very beautiful. But as soon as, if you're a fool, if you open your mouth, then we'll know. So when he speaks, then you can understand what he is. So my speaking is there in the books. And if you are intelligent, you can understand. You haven't got to ask. Just like in a court, a big lawyer is known when he speaks. Otherwise, everybody is a good lawyer. But when he speaks in court, then it is known whether he's a good lawyer or not. So you have to hear and you have to read, and then you'll understand. The real understanding is there. So he told her, you just read my books then. So a couple of weeks later, we were in London. And another interview, this was with this young man. He was from the London Broadcasting Company, Mike Robinson. And he did a really excellent interview. At the end of it, Prabhupada told us, he said, 90% of our philosophy is in that interview. He said it must be immediately published in Back to Godhead. So he was really happy with it. The boy was sharp. He asked good questions. And after a long interview, finally he was coming to the end. So, apparently satisfied, Mike asked his remaining question. Perhaps finally then, I could ask you, do you ever have any doubts? He's asking Prabhupada. Prabhupada's eyes widened. If I have doubts, how am I preaching? That means I am cheating. How am I writing so many books? Do you think that a man with doubt can produce, in a doubtful condition, he can produce so many books? Do you think like that? Mike became a little sheepish, especially hearing us chuckling in the background. Well, I don't know. I just... Well, you should know, Prabhupada declared, his strength of conviction making us all laugh. So you never have any doubt about any of this. Nothing at all. Prabhupada smiled at him. We are sure. So that was nice. How long are we going for? Till 9? Okay. So, previously we'd mentioned Prabhupada made that comment that Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was not happy because none of his disciples were producing books. So this came up. I'd been with Prabhupada 2 months. We were in Calcutta. Tamal Krishna Maharaj was the visiting secretary for the month of January. And he and Jayapataka Maharaj, they'd gone off to visit one of the local Gaudiya mats. They heard there was some festival going on there. So they'd gone as a courtesy to visit. So then about 12:30 p.m. during Prabhupada's massage, this was on January the 14th, which he took sitting on a mat in a little patch of sunlight on the bathroom floor. Excuse me. Because in Calcutta, you know, the facilities were quite crude. And there was a very small bathroom, and Prabhupada was taking... He liked to sit in the sunshine and take his massage. So there was a little spot of sunlight coming through into the bathroom there. So he was sitting taking his massage. Tamal Krishna Maharaj came back and gave a report on the visit that he and Jayapataka Maharaj had just made to the Sri Chaitanya Mat. They had talked with Madhava Maharaj, Prabhupada's godbrother, showing him Prabhupada's translation of the Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita. They asked if Prabhupada's books could be displayed there during a current 5-day festival that the Mat was holding. It's quite bold in one sense. But Madhava Maharaj only gave them excuses why it was not possible. As they were leaving the mat, Tamal Krishna and Jayapataka stopped to talk with the secretary. He appeared interested and friendly, and he inquired about the books. The secretary said that he felt that they should be following our example in preaching, but they were too tied up with routine temple maintenance work. So, looking over the advertising brochure that Tamal Krishna had brought back, Prabhupada noted that the invited speakers included no sannyasis or spiritual personalities. They were simply government ministers and the like. So whereas for us, Prabhupada's books are the main feature of our preaching work, Prabhupada said that, just see, after 40 years, they are still selling Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati's books. He was critical that they have not been able to produce any literature of their own. He said that many of his godbrothers were envious of his success, and he specifically named 3 of them. His comment showed that he has learned not to expect anything from them. He told us that we should avoid dealing with them. He said that rather than help, they will simply attempt to spoil our own work. So we got a lot of comments. If you were in India, you knew what Prabhupada's, you know, mood was there. And he was very strict about it. You don't go around, you don't mix with them. All they'll do is just make problems. So this was one point that I really noted that. He said after 40 years, they're still just selling it. Because he wasn't criticizing him for selling Srila Bhaktisiddhanta's books, but he was criticizing them that they didn't have any other books after 40 years. They had produced nothing. And, of course, that was Prabhupada's whole endeavor, was, you know, our entire preaching was based on his books. So, again, later in the year, we were in Hyderabad, and Prabhupada had just opened the temple on Janmashtami. He had his Vyasa Puja, and Jayapataka Swami had flown over with Gaga Muni. So, on August the 21st, then they were having a final darshan of Srila Prabhupada before departing back to Calcutta. So along with Gaga Muni Maharaj, Jayapataka Maharaj heard from Srila Prabhupada of the proactive stance that Prabhupada is taking against all the false propaganda. So we'd arrived back in India and this whole CIA thing had blown up. It was in all the newspapers. ISKCON is just the CIA. We're all spies, you know. And it was brought up in the Indian Parliament. Why are these, you know, this CIA organization, they're operating all over India. They should be investigated. Where did they get so much money from? This man is an old sadhu. He leaves India. He has nothing. He comes back with the Americans. He's got money all over the place. He's building. He must be getting it from the American government. That's what they thought. And even some of Prabhupada's own God brothers were saying yes. Otherwise, how could he get so much money? Yeah, he's being paid by the American government. This is what's going on. So Prabhupada informed them of a letter that he was writing to Mr. Chanareddy, one of the state governors. I think Chanareddy, Chanareddy was the one that opened the, he came for the opening of the Krishna Balaram Mandir. Is that right? Yes. So Prabhupada wrote to him. He said, I'm writing one letter to the governor that I work hard. I print my books and they are selling. And if I bring that money to construct a temple, then why are people envious? What is the wrong there? Rather, I should be encouraged that I am bringing so much money into India, foreign exchange, by my very, very hard labor. So why are they envious? Gagamuni said that he felt that it was difficult for them to believe that a sadhu could possess so much money from selling books. That may be beyond their dream, Prabhupada said, but I am not a so-called sadhu. I am trying to execute the orders of my Guru Maharaj, predecessor. I am not a so-called sadhu, taking the saffron robe and begging for fulfilling the belly. They have to accept you as an international leader, Gagamuni said. I must be international leader, Prabhupada agreed, as a matter of fact, adding that such a huge sale of a single person's books, especially philosophical and religious works, was unique in history. He laughed and he said that the public generally considered such literature untouchable. Thus his feat was even more remarkable. Observing that the Mayavadi, Vivekananda, had produced only one small booklet, Thus Spake. They have this little book, Thus Spake Vivekananda. And that two of his own leading God brothers, Bon and Tirtha Maharajas, had not been able to produce any substantial literature, Prabhupada said that they were chalas, bluffers, who make a show but have no real assets. What is that? Bon Maharaj, Institute for Indian Culture and Philosophy? But where is your book? So I think he tried to translate the Nectar of Devotion. He got halfway through and not even that much. And that was it. At that time, there was a little bit of stuff going on between Prabhupada and Bon Maharaj. Because, of course, Bon Maharaj had come to the West and then, you know, not really done much, anything. And then Prabhupada had come much later on and then had this huge success. But Bon Maharaj had had some contacts that he'd established in the West. And in 1975, when the Chaitanya Charitamrita was published, and that, you know, the Library Party was getting really active. They were really going out and selling standing orders. Prabhupada got a report back that Bon Maharaj was going around and telling all the professors not to buy Prabhupada's books. So Prabhupada was furious about that, and he said, that's it. He said, we'll have no more dealings with that man. So this was another comment that he made. All right, so where is your book? You have your institute, but no books. So anyway, writing. That was Prabhupada's main occupation, and he had expressed, you know, on occasions that he just wanted to be freed from management so that he could sit down and do his real work. So one occasion like that was February the 28th, 1976. He was in Mayapur. And Prabhupada had spoken with Kirti Raj the day before. Kirti Raj at that time was starting, you know, he was doing some preaching in Poland. He'd been writing for several years to different people there. He had some plans to go and stay there and preach. So Kirti Raj had come to Mayapur and he presented some plans to Srila Prabhupada for preaching work in Poland. But then Hansaduta came, and after hearing that Hansaduta had already formulated another strategy, Prabhupada cancelled his own suggestions. He had given some suggestions himself to Kirti Raj, But then, you know, he's a GBC. He came in, he said, oh, I've got, you know, these plans. So Prabhupada said, all right, you do that. And he cancelled his own plans. He told Kirti Raj to simply follow the GBC's instructions. So this policy of referring things for GBC approval, both individually and collectively, is something that Prabhupada is doing more and more. His divine grace often says that he wants to be relieved from management as soon as possible, not when he leaves the planet, but long before, so that he can retire and write his books. So we got to Hawaii. He's doing all this writing. The intention was, you know, to avoid management, no visitors. But still, you know, some problems were there. So one problem arose between the temple president, Sukadev Prabhu, he can tell you all about this, and the local GBC, who shall not be named. So they got, you know, in a fight. So after that, then Sukadev came to Srila Prabhupada and he complained, you know, I'm being harassed in this way and that way. He's saying so many things like this and that. He was disturbed. So that Prabhupada was the one who had to settle the whole issue. He had to get involved and talk to the two of them and settle it down. So he wasn't happy about that. So in the evening, on May the 18th then, he wrote he spoke a long time about how it would be very difficult to finish the Srimad Bhagavatam if so many management problems continue to arise. He dictated a general letter to all the GBC members asking them to become more responsible and to relieve him of managerial burdens. He compared his ISKCON movement to the British Empire, saying that it was actually more extensive because we have not yet finished our expansion. There was an old saying that the sun never sets on the British Empire. You know, the Brits, they were very proud of their empire. The sun never sets. In other words, we're all around the world. So somewhere the sun is rising on the British Empire. That was the idea. So Prabhupada, of course, being brought up in, you know, the British Raj days in India, he would naturally make that comparison. So he said ISKCON was more extensive, and we had actually not even finished yet. So he wants the growth to continue, but he also wants to be given the opportunity to complete his translation work. He wrote, I must now remind you that I have to complete the translation of the Srimad Bhagavatam. That is the greatest contribution. Our books have given us a respectable position. People have no faith in this church or temple worship. Those days are gone. Of course, we have to keep our spirits high. Simply intellectualism will not do. There must be practical purification. So I request you to relieve me of managerial responsibilities more and more so that I can complete the Srimad Bhagavatam translation. If I am always having to manage, then I cannot do my work on my books. It is document. I have to choose each word very soberly. And if I have to think of management, then I cannot do this. I cannot be like these rascals who present something mental concoction to cheat the public. So this task will not be finished without the cooperation of my appointed assistants, the GBC, temple presidents, and sannyasis. I have chosen my best men to be GBC, and I do not want that the GBC should be disrespectful to the temple presidents. You can naturally consult me, but if the basic principle is weak, then how will things go on? So please assist me in the management so that I can be free to finish the Srimad Bhagavatam, which will be our lasting contribution to the world. So that was sent to all the GBCs. And one last little example. Again, Prabhupada talking about wanting to withdraw from the management. We had arrived in Toronto. Prabhupada had just spent a week in Detroit. So at that time, Govardhan had been the temple president, but then he had been removed. There was some, you know, discrepancy. He wasn't chanting his 16 rounds, basically. That was the main complaint. So Prabhupada got there, and a new temple president had been installed. And whilst we were in Detroit, Prabhupada didn't say anything. As soon as we left Detroit and went to Toronto, then he called in Jagadish. And then he began to discuss with him what he'd observed in Detroit. So he wanted to know why the previous temple president, Govardhan Das, had been removed. He was well liked by the devotees, and Prabhupada agreed with Jagadish's description of him as a very gentle soul. Prabhupada said that he had rendered tangible devotional service. It was due to him that Ambarish and Lekha Sravanti Prabhus had been engaged in obtaining the Fisher estate. Moreover, Srila Prabhupada had received complaints in Detroit about the new temple president, who he said was an intelligent man and a good preacher, but in other temples had also been the center of controversy over his lavish spending habits. Although Prabhupada had initiated this conversation, when Jagadish Prabhu asked him what he should do about it, Prabhupada declined to direct him. He just brought it up, but he didn't tell him what to do with it. He said, "No, I do not wish to interfere. You manage now. I want to see that you are managing without my interference. Now, practically, I want to concentrate more on writing books. Or absolutely, I want to do that. But sometimes this mismanagement gives me too much anxiety. I do not wish to see that somehow or another we have built up such a nice institution and on account of lack of management that it may be hampered. That is my only anxiety." So, I'm going to finish at that point. It's 9 o'clock. I hope that gives some insights into, you know, the effort, you know, the inspiration, the importance Prabhupada put or attached to his books. This is the movement. It's all books are the basis. That's it. And, you know, when we appreciate how much effort Prabhupada put into writing his books, it should make us realize just, you know, how important it is to go out and sell those books also. There's a lot more that could be said about book distribution, but that's already been done many times before. Suhas Prabhu's here. I'm sure he reminds everybody every day. But, you know, it's nice to get this, you know, other angle, looking, you know, from the inside, so to speak, and seeing what was going on in Prabhupada's rooms and what he was thinking and saying about, you know, his book production. Is there any questions or comments at this point?
I have a question. Where did that come from 10,000 years, based on these books will be the law books for the next 10,000 years? Is that an actual quote from Prabhupada? Because I thought
I
heard
Prabhupada
say that one time, and
Bhajan
Narayan asked me, because they can't find it written
right to them.
Yes. Yes.
I heard it was in the car.
Well, all right, so the question was that quote about Prabhupada's books being the law books for the next 10,000 years was in wide circulation. I mean, everybody in ISKCON knew about it. We all used to quote it. But for some reason or another, it was never recorded. We can't find any letter, and we can't find any, you know, actual recording of Prabhupada saying that. But many devotees knew about it. And I can't say exactly what the source is.
Where I heard it was at the Berkeley, when they first brought Srila Prabhupada to the new Berkeley temple. Oh. I was sitting right at the foot of the Vyasasana, and he was being interviewed and quite a few reporters were there. And they were asking him about the Rath Yatra and everything. And then they said, "So Swami, when you die," and he interrupted them, and he said, "I will not die. He said, I will live on in my books, and these books will be the law books for the next 10,000 years." That's
so you,
where I heard it.
You heard it.
That's the source.
I'm not confident in my memory. So
maybe you should undergo a course of hypnosis and, you know, recall it. Who was the TP at that time?
At that point, everybody was supposed to go out on Harinam, and I was sewing the Rath Yatra canopies for the cart, so I just ran into the temple.
Who was the TP at that time?
And it wasn't tape recorded. And it was such, there were so many reporters there.
Who was the TP at that time? Can you remember? What year was it?
Was it true about
75. Maybe somebody could do a little further investigation. But, you know, that's, you're a first hand source.
Well, Audrey asked me, it's not recorded, then you just mentioned it.
Yeah. Well, it's something that we all knew. I mean, we all heard anyway. And I never heard any denial of that from Prabhupada or anything. So, Shruta, you have any comment on that one?
Here, the Maharaj passed away. We heard, you know, he wanted his samadhi to be right next to Gaurakishore's, you know, which is kind of audacious.
Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati.
Oh, it was Bhaktisiddhanta?
Yes.
And I had heard the devotees ask him what happened to Tirtha Maharaj, and I heard Prabhupada had said that he had gone back to Godhead. Had you heard that also?
Yes. I think it was September or October of 76 when Tirtha Maharaj left his body. And Jayapataka Maharaj sent a letter or a telegram to Prabhupada saying that he'd left and that they were going to put him in samadhi with Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati or right next to him. And he put this comment, he said, ISKCON is protesting. And then Prabhupada wrote back, he said, don't say anything. He said, we had nothing to do with him when he was alive, and we'll have nothing to do with him now he's dead. So, you know, he said, don't get mixed up in all of this. Let them do whatever they like. Later on, I didn't directly hear it from Prabhupada, but I did hear that Prabhupada said that he went back to Godhead. And then, you know, we were kind of puzzled about how that could have happened, because Prabhupada was so critical of him. And then Prabhupada said, no, but still, he spent his life serving his Guru Maharaj. So on account of that, even though, you know, there were so many problems with, you know, his dealings with his other god brothers, still Prabhupada said on that basis that he dedicated his life to his spiritual master, then he went back to Godhead. Vyasa King Prabhu.
He said that, and he said, my Guru Maharaj accepted his service. All
right,
that's
yes.
That's why he went, because
good.
My,
yes,
Guru,
my
Maharaj
Guru Maharaj accepted,
his service.
Right. Yes. Thank you for yeah.
There's another point that I wanted to say, how we really appreciated hearing how you were talking about Prabhupada so deeply, was absorbed in choosing every single word so that we could understand. Mm. So my question is, why would we want to change his books? Change the words?
That's actually, you're asking about the editing or changing?
He chose every single word, you said, very thoughtfully. So that my question is, why we're thinking we can do better.
All right, well, that's a loaded question.
Well, I don't know, because I just want to know the answer. What's the load?
I can tell you what my experience was in terms of Prabhupada's editing of Prabhupada's books. The editing of Prabhupada's books was already going on when I joined the party. The first canto had already been revised, because in the process of production, there were a lot of mistakes that were made. Sanskrit editors, English editors, maybe they misheard things, you know, on the tapes. In particular, you know, the Bhagavad Gita was riddled with problems, and Prabhupada was aware of them. And he had already told the BBT editors, Jayad Waiter and others, that they had to, you know, redo those books and re-edit those books. So it's not like, you know, everything, at least Prabhupada knew there were problems, you know. Not big things, but there were lots of small things. Whenever, you know, readings were going on, Prabhupada would pick up on a Sanskrit word or, an expression or something that wasn't right. You know, a classic example I think that we all know about was in the Gita. We'd read out in Melbourne, about the duties of the Vaishyas. And the translation is cattle raising. So the next day on the morning, we were driving out for the morning walk. Prabhupada brought that up. He said, he has said cattle raising. He said, it is not cattle raising, it is cow protection. Yeah. So he didn't like that. And he said the BBT should change that. So that process was already going on. And the BBT editors just continued on with the service that Prabhupada had already given them. You know, naturally they didn't just stop it when Prabhupada left. They just continued on. I'll say something about the Bhagavad Gita, because I do know something about that. And that I think in 82, Jayadvaita Maharaj had come to Detroit. There was a GBC meeting there. And he had brought with him this package, which was all the proposed editorial changes that they wanted to do, you know, for the Bhagavad Gita. So we had a long discussion about it. And then when we actually started looking at the, proposed editorial changes, we realized it has to be done. You know, there were some real problems. One of them was, what's that verse in the second chapter? Nor having once been, does he ever cease to be. Yeah? For the soul, there is neither birth nor death. Nor having once been, does he ever cease to be. Now, I think Mangalananda had even made a song of that. For the soul, there is never birth nor death. Right? Nor having once been, does he ever cease to be. He's unborn, he's undying. Like, right, you remember that song. So, Jayadvaita Maharaj wanted to change that. I said, what? Wait a minute, I'd been singing that, I liked it. And then he pointed out, he said, that's not what the actual Sanskrit says. And it's not the way that Prabhupada actually translated it. And then he explained what had happened. Hayagriva was given the Bhagavad Gita to edit. So he didn't like Prabhupada's translations. He thought they weren't poetic enough. So what he did was he borrowed a lot of English translations from Dr. Radhakrishna, from that version, because it was written in a more kind of poetic way. So, for the soul that hath never birth nor death, nor having once been, does he ever cease to be. It's not our philosophy. It's not our philosophy that having once being, does he ever cease to be? I remember as a Bhakta when I read that, it didn't sound right. But I didn't know enough at that time. Then when I looked at that, and Jayadvaita Maharaj explained it, it's Christian philosophy. The soul is created, it comes into being, and then it's eternal. But in the Sanskrit, if you look at it, it says, he has not come into being, he does not come into being, he will not come into being. He is eternal. That means that he exists in all the three phases of time. And it's very specific, and that's the way that Prabhupada translated it. So they had, for the first six chapters, they had Prabhupada's hand-typed original translation. So what he wanted to do was to go back and take it as close as possible back to that original. That's actually Prabhupada's Gita. The one that we got printed, Macmillan did, it was, tinged with Hayagriva's Gita. That's a fact. So they had the first six chapters. They had the second six chapters. They had the first edited version of it. The original manuscript was gone, but they had the first edited version. So it was still possible to take it quite closely back. Now, what he told us, well, I can be corrected on this, but I'm just giving an example of it. But what he told us was that the first six chapters, they had the original. The second six chapters, they had the first edited version of it. And then the last six chapters, they didn't have anything. So then they had to just work on, you know, what they knew from Prabhupada's other works, how he translated things, and, you know, whatever expertise they developed in English and Sanskrit editing on Prabhupada's books. So, you know, there was a lot of, you know, major editorial stuff that was going on there. But the fact is that the so-called new Gita is actually the old Gita. It's the original Gita that Prabhupada originally wrote. And Hayagriva's version, because, yeah, I mean, he was sincere, I'm not, you know, complaining about that, but Prabhupada complained about his editing afterwards. There was another example I can give when we were in Hawaii. Hayagriva arrived. He's working on the philosophy book. And I was in Prabhupada's room one morning, and we were just talking, just chatting. And he was talking about the moon. You know, he was talking about the moon landing and how bogus it was. So he said, in my book, right, Easy Journey to Other Planets, he said, you have read, he said, I've written there that it is simply a childish attempt. So he said, you've read that? And I was sitting there and I actually couldn't remember having read it. But I said, you know, well, I read that book in 1972 when I joined, so I haven't read it for 4 years. I can't, you know. So then Prabhupada looked at me and he said, get me a copy. So I went off, I ran around, I found a copy of Easy Journey to Other Planets, and Prabhupada read it himself. So he went through it and he found out that paragraph was not there. It had been knocked out. He was furious. And it just happened that Hayagriva was there, and he was the editor. So on the morning walk, Prabhupada called him in, and then on the morning walk, spent the whole morning walk complaining about how he had no faith in his guru, and he had more faith in the scientists. But he didn't like, he wasn't talking directly at him, but everything he said was about him. Hayagriva was at the back, he had his head down. And we came back to the temple, and then Prabhupada went in his room to take his breakfast. I happened to go into the room that Hayagriva was staying in, and he looked up at me and he said, you know, what's he so grumpy about? He's talking about Srila Prabhupada. So I was really angry. I got right on his case. We had a big argument in the room, and I told him, I said, you have no faith. You know, I said, you've changed that. He said, oh, you know, that was written before they went to the moon. So he said, nobody's going to believe that now. I said, we don't care what people believe. You know, they believe something now, in 20 years' time, they'll believe something else. I said, our business is just to give whatever Prabhupada said, that's all. And, you know, he was all... So I stomped out of the room. I got really, you know, on his case about it, and then that was it. So then a few minutes later, I saw him walk past in the corridor. He went into Prabhupada's room. He was crying and he apologized. He offered his dandabats. And so then Prabhupada said, all right. But he said, now it has to be changed. So we had to send a message to Radha Balaba. He was the production manager, that now you've got to re-edit the whole Easy Journey to Other Planets and put everything back in. But that was Hayagriva's mentality. He actually thought, you know, the scientists either were right, or, you know, the public wouldn't believe something Prabhupada said, so we shouldn't say it, or we shouldn't print it, we should knock it out. So he did things like that when he was doing his editing. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff that had to be redone because of that kind of mentality. So all I can say in summary is that Prabhupada was aware of that, and therefore he had already initiated the editing of his books during his time. They were supposed to be doing the second canto when I joined Prabhupada's party. That was at the end of 75. Later on, they reprinted it. There's a letter from Radha Balaba to Prabhupada where he says, Nittai's not doing any work on your books, and we want to reprint the second canto. So can we go ahead and do that even though we haven't got the new edits? So Prabhupada said, yes, don't wait for them, just go ahead and do it. But they were supposed to be editing it. That was the thing. I know there's lots of other comments, but, you know, that's my experience.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, because publishing Prabhupada's books is my heart and soul. There's one of the very famous Hayagrivaism that Prabhupada personally smashed, and that was when he translated Sri Bhagavanavacha as "the Blessed Lord said." Prabhupada personally changed that. We still find it sprinkled throughout the books because they took the translations from the original and put it in purports throughout. Right. But Sri Bhagavanavacha does not mean "the Blessed Lord said." A lot of devotees got upset when it was changed to "the Supreme Personality," but Prabhupada himself changed that. Yes. He said, "What Blessed Lord? Who has said this?" Sri Bhagavanavacha means "the Supreme Personality of God has said," not "the Blessed Lord said."
Yes. That was from Radha Krishna, "the Blessed Lord said." Well, the best example of that was the Planet of Trees, right? Which we all read. We all thought, what is a planet of trees? Far out. Pitri Loka. So the young guy that was a student wasn't even a devotee that had been asked to sit down and transcribe Prabhupada's tapes. He was there for a fortnight or something, right? And he was just some student that turned up and he did some typing and off he went. They never saw him again. He listened to that. He knew a loka was a planet. So Pitri Loka, Tree Loka. All right, planet of trees. So that's what he put. And that was printed. There are lots of stuff like that. And another, a final one. I can't remember all the details of this one, but Hayagriva was in 66, when they were working on that, he still was under the impression that the universal form was the supreme form of God. And so in the 18th chapter of the Gita there, there's some verse where that comes up again in the purport. And he changed it because he was thinking that, you know, the universal form is actually the supreme. And there was some comment that Prabhupada had made. So he edited that so that it would be consistent with the universal form being the supreme form of the Lord. So there were things like that that were going on. And you really, last year I had one senior devotee that came. I saw him in Atlanta. He started, you know, asking me the same thing about, what about, you know, they've edited, changed Prabhupada's books, blah, blah, blah. He's getting all infuriated about it. So I asked him, I said, have you actually read the changes, so-called changes, and edited, you know? He said, well, no. So then I gave him these same examples. And he said, oh. He said, I didn't know that. I said, well, you know, what are you getting all upset about? You haven't even read what's been done yet. He said, go back and read the whole thing, see what they've done. If they have complaints after that, then come back. But, you know, it was just an issue. Oh, it's all emotional. Oh, they've changed Prabhupada's books. Yeah, you can't change Prabhupada's books. But with no knowledge in the background. So, yeah, I mean, these things are very, you know, they're serious discussions. They are serious issues. But you really have to know, you know, what you're talking about before you pursue it, you know. So that's my advice, is read it all. I know Jai Dwaita Maharaj has, you know, put out all the, you know, the stuff that they did for the Gita. He's published that. And you can read through it, every single edit, every so-called change, whatever. It's all there. That's the best thing. Have we got time for any more questions, or are we finishing?
I think we're finishing. If anybody wants to ask you further questions, they can just ask you.
All right. Sorry.